All right, ready to dive in.
Okay.
Today, we're tackling ancient Israel and this huge power shift from King Saul to King David.
Sounds intense.
It is. And get this, we'll be throwing in some Hebrew terms along the way.
Oh, wow, like a biblical language lesson.
Exactly. It'll be like a historical thriller, but with, you know, a spiritual side.
Absolutely. It's wild how the Bible presents this transition, not like a smooth handover, but more like this, well, like this tangle of human choices.
Right.
And I'd even say some divine intervention.
Oh, for sure. The source for this deep dive, by the way, is a lecture by Dr. Elaine Phillips on Old Testament literature.
Yes, she's great.
She unpacks 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, basically putting us right there with these larger-than-life figures.
Like we're flies on the wall.
Totally. So the big question is, how does Saul, who seemed to be chosen by God, lose that favor?
Right.
And then it makes way for David, the man after God's own heart. I mean, you got to wonder, did the Israelites back then feel like they were watching some Shakespearean tragedy play out in real time?
Oh, I bet. With, like, their whole nation at stake. And speaking of drama, Dr. Phillips points out these two major missteps that lead to Saul's downfall.
Okay, lay on me.
A presumptuous sacrifice at Gilgal, and then his failure to totally wipe out the Amalekites like God commanded.
Oh, so just straight up disobedience.
Exactly. Plain and simple.
But you know what's interesting? David messes up pretty badly later on, too.
He does, yeah.
Adultery, murder, deceit. They both have some serious skeletons, right?
Oh, yeah.
So why is Saul judged so quickly while David gets more time to, you know, repent? It almost seems like there's different rules for each of them.
That's a question that's really stumped theologians for ages.
I can imagine.
It brings up big questions about God's justice and mercy.
Right.
Some scholars think God was being merciful to Saul, giving him chances to turn back, but Saul just didn't take them.
Oh, like he missed his opportunity.
Exactly. Others suggest this whole period was actually God's way of getting David ready for leadership, shaping him through hardship, really testing his heart. It's like God was using this time to mold David into the perfect leader Israel needed.
Oh, I see what you mean, like a super intense training montage.
Mm.
But for a king, not Rocky.
Precisely. And there's another layer to this, one that's really intriguing.
Ooh, I like where this is going.
Maybe God was using Saul's reign and then the whole downfall to teach the Israelites a big lesson.
Like what?
Like maybe kings weren't always the perfect answer.
Huh. That really makes you think. It challenges what we assume about power and how God works, you know, sometimes in ways we just don't expect.
Exactly. And this brings us to another really cool part of this whole saga, the Spirit of God in both Saul and David.
Yeah, it's almost like there's two different kinds of divine intervention going on at the same time.
You got it.
Dr. Phillips mentioned that God's Spirit would come upon Saul, like at specific times.
Right, right.
Like leading Israel in battle, but it was temporary.
Yeah.
It was like this burst of energy. But with David, it's a whole different story.
Completely different. With David, the Spirit arrived with this, like, this power, and it seemed to stay with him. You know,
right, stuck around.
Like a much deeper, longer-lasting connection.
I gotcha. But then there's this whole evil spirit thing tormenting Saul. It almost feels like a psychological thriller got thrown into the mix.
It does. And, you know, Dr. Phillips suggests it might be part of God judging Saul for his disobedience.
Oh, wow.
It really adds this whole other layer to Saul's story. When you think about it, it kind of reminds us that we may not always understand why bad stuff happens in our lives, but maybe, just maybe, God can use even those tough times to do something good.
That's actually a really comforting thought.
It is.
It reminds me of that part in Psalm 51 where David's afraid of losing the Spirit. He's pleading with God not to take it away.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he saw what happened to Saul and was terrified of ending up the same way.
That's a really insightful observation. It makes you think that David learned from Saul's mistakes. You know?
Yeah.
He saw what happened when you lose that connection with God.
Okay, let's shift gears for a sec and talk about David's rise to power.
Let's do it.
Dr. Phillips talks about his humble beginnings as a shepherd.
Right, right.
It's amazing to think that all those years with sheep were actually preparing him for being king.
It's crazy how that works.
It makes you wonder what seemingly boring stuff we're doing now that's, like, shaping us for something bigger.
What a question. Like, what are those hidden purposes behind everyday things? Think about David protecting his sheep from, like, lions and bears.
Oh, yeah.
Honing those slingshot skills, that seemingly small thing became the reason he won against Goliath.
That's incredible. Talk about an unexpected path to greatness.
Yeah.
And the whole David and Goliath story is just Well, it's unforgettable.
It is.
David's total faith in God, his anger at Goliath being all defiant, a shepherd boy taking down a giant warrior. Mm. That story just keeps hitting people across cultures and centuries.
And if you think about where it happened geographically, it adds a whole other level to the drama. Picture this, the Elah Valley. It's this strategic gateway into the Judean Hill Country.
Okay.
The Philistines are camped there. They're about to overrun the Israelite heartland. It's a fight for survival.
Oh, wow. High stakes.
And here comes this young shepherd, David, just bringing food to his brothers who were in Saul's army.
Right.
But then he hears Goliath taunting everyone, and it's like something snaps inside him.
That's it.
It's not just about taking down a giant. It's about protecting God's honor and his people.
And, spoiler alert, we all know how that fight ends. David, with his faith and that slingshot, takes down Goliath. Total shockwaves through both armies. But this win, it changes everything.
Definitely.
It makes David famous and sets the stage for a new conflict, one that pits him against King Saul himself.
Oh, yeah. Because success can sometimes make people jealous, yeah. And Saul starts getting paranoid. All of a sudden, the songs celebrating David are a constant reminder of the threat he poses.
Right, like, hey, remember how awesome David is?
And to make it even worse, David marries Michal, Saul's daughter. Dr. Phillips even points out this interesting fact about the bride price. 200 Philistine foreskins. It's a detail you just can't forget. It really shows how brutal things were back then.
200. That's, yeah, a vivid picture for sure.
In Hebrew, they called this mohar.
Huh. It's a huge reminder of how different things were.
But
in all this drama and violence, there's this beautiful contrast. The friendship between David and Jonathan, Saul's son.
Oh, yeah.
It's this bond of loyalty so selfless. It seems to rise above all the political chaos around them.
Jonathan's integrity is remarkable. He knows David deserves to be king and backs him, even if it means risking his own claim to the throne.
So he's putting friendship and justice before his own ambition.
Exactly.
He's a true friend. Sadly, their bond can't protect David from Saul's anger, which is getting worse. Saul gets more paranoid. David has to run. Basically becomes a fugitive in his own land.
Right. And his time on the run is this mix of daring escapes and, well, tragic outcomes.
Like what?
Like that incident at Nob. David, desperate, needs supplies. He tricks the priest Ahimelech.
Oh, so.
Saying he's on a mission for Saul. He gets consecrated bread, which was only for priests, and even gets Goliath's sword.
Wow.
But this lie has a domino effect. Doeg the Edomite, an informant for Saul, sees this and runs back to the king.
Oh, no.
Saul, totally suspicious and angry, orders all the priests at Nob to be executed. It's awful. Driven by paranoia and zero reason, 85 priests are killed just for being kind to David.
That's a scary example of Saul's madness causing huge damage.
Yeah.
He's so jealous he lashes out at innocent religious people.
But there is a bit of hope in all this. One priest, Abiathar, escapes. He takes the ephod, a sacred garment with the Urim and Thummim inside.
Remind me what those are again.
They're these objects the high priest uses to ask God for guidance. Think of them like sacred dice giving a yes or no answer.
Oh, right. So that's how David is able to inquire of the Lord later on.
Exactly. It's a crucial piece of the story that gets passed down so that communication with God can continue.
Like a vital plot device.
You could say that. It shows that even in chaos and violence, God's still there, guiding things, sometimes in surprising ways. And speaking of surprises, David ends up seeking refuge with the Philistines, the very people he defeated.
That's crazy. He goes from bad to worse.
He winds up in Ziklag, a city given to him by Achish, the Philistine king.
Yeah.
Dr. Phillips points out that Ziklag was really important strategically. It was on a major spice trade route through the Negev Desert. It's interesting to think about how geography was so vital back then.
Totally.
Control over trade meant control over money and power. This detail helps us understand why Achish trusted David with this specific area. He needed someone reliable watching over this crucial economic lifeline.
Right, like a strategic partnership.
But David, the clever guy he is, uses his position in Ziklag to his advantage.
Oh, how so?
He attacks nomadic groups nearby, but tells Achish he's actually attacking Israelites. He's playing both sides. It's brilliant and deceitful, and it accomplishes two things. It makes Achish trust him, think he's on his side. But he's also protecting the southern border of Judah, gaining favor with his own people. He's setting himself up for leadership down the road.
Wow. He's strengthening his position while laying the groundwork for becoming king of Judah. It's like a masterclass in political maneuvering.
It is.
But while David is busy in the south, things are going downhill in the north. The Philistines, seeing Saul's weakness, have launched a full-on invasion. They're pushing deep into Israelite territory. It's getting desperate.
It is. And this is where Saul reaches peak desperation. His army is stuck, God's gone silent, and he makes a huge decision.
What's that?
He goes to a witch at Endor for guidance, even though that was totally forbidden in Israelite law.
He's breaking his own religious rules. That's how bad it is.
It's a last-ditch effort to find some answers, some divine strategy. He's willing to risk it all. And to make it even tenser, he has to sneak past enemy lines to get to her under cover of darkness. You can almost feel how heavy his despair is.
Yeah. That's a powerful image. The once mighty King Saul, who had the Spirit of God, is now sneaking around to talk to a witch. So, what happens next?
What happens next is one of the most chilling scenes in the entire Bible. The witch summons the spirit of Samuel. The prophet who anointed Saul as king, but later called him out for his disobedience.
Wait, hold on. She actually brings Samuel back? Is that even possible?
That's the crazy part. Even the witch seems scared of what she's done. It's like this heavy, otherworldly feeling.
Screw you.
And Samuel's message to Saul is just devastating. Imagine being confronted by the ghost of the person you disobeyed, the one who made you king.
Okay, now I've got chills. What does he say?
He tells Saul straight up that God is against him now. He's become his enemy. He confirms that the kingdom is going to David and predicts that both Saul and his sons will die the next day in battle. It's like a death sentence from beyond the grave.
It's like a final judgment, a confirmation that Saul's path has led him to this unavoidable end. You can almost feel those words crushing him.
And sadly, Samuel's right. The next day, the Philistines destroy the Israelite army. Saul is badly wounded, facing capture, and chooses to kill himself rather than be humiliated by his enemies.
What a tragic end for a guy who started with so much promise. It really shows that even those chosen by God can fall if they choose disobedience over humility and trust.
Absolutely. And what happens after the battle is just as grim. The Philistines do terrible things to Saul's body, cut off his head, and display his armor in their temples like trophies.
Oh, that's awful.
It's a brutal reminder of how brutal war was and how humiliating defeat could be.
Yeah.
But even in this darkness, there's some loyalty and respect. The people of Jabesh Gilead, they remember how Saul saved them years ago. They risk going into enemy territory to get his body and bury him properly.
That's a powerful act of kindness. Shows that even in death, there can be grace and redemption.
Yes, it does. And as news of Saul's death spreads, an Amalekite shows up at David's camp. He says he killed the king, hoping for a reward.
Really?
But David, even with his complicated relationship with Saul, is horrified.
Of course.
He refuses to reward the guy for harming the Lord's anointed and has him executed.
Wow.
This is really important. It shows that David, even as Saul's rival, still respected the kingship, which was ordained by God. He understood that even in death, Saul deserved respect as the chosen king.
That's a good point.
And lastly, to show his grief and honor Saul, David writes a lament, a song of mourning that captures both the tragedy of Saul's downfall and how deep his friendship with Jonathan was. It's really moving, and it shows how complex David was. He's a strong, decisive guy, but also deeply affected by loss and capable of huge empathy.
It's a powerful ending to this chapter in Israel's history. A reminder of the ups and downs of leadership, what happens when you disobey, and how powerful human connection can be, even in tragedy.
It really is. So we saw how Saul's story ended. You might think David just steps right in and becomes king, but it's not that simple, is it?
It rarely is, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, think about how messy transitions of power are throughout history. Someone's always fighting for control. I doubt ancient Israel was any different.
You're totally right. It wasn't a clean break. More like this messy, complicated scramble for power. Instead of everyone uniting under David, the kingdom actually splits.
Splits. So no smooth transition from Saul to David.
Not quite. First, David is anointed king, but just over his own tribe, Judah. Up north, some of Saul's people support his son, Ishbosheth, as king.
Wait a minute. Saul had another son. I thought Jonathan was supposed to be king.
Yeah, you're remembering right. Jonathan was the favorite, but he died with Saul in that last battle, remember?
Oh, right.
So Ishbosheth, who wasn't nearly as charismatic, comes into the picture.
Okay, so there's this power vacuum, two guys wanting the throne. Sounds like a recipe for a huge power struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Did David try to conquer the north?
It was a wild time, super unstable, like a Game of Thrones, ancient Israel style. For the next few years, there were all these fights and power plays between David's forces and those loyal to Ishbosheth. It just shows that even when it seems like there's an obvious choice for leader, things don't always go peacefully.
So how does David finally become king of all of Israel? Was it by force or by being smart politically?
It's kind of both. He won some important battles, showing he was a strong military leader, and that solidified his control in the South. But people also started feeling like David was meant to be king, like God wanted it that way. Remember, Samuel anointed him. He was chosen to replace Saul. It's like that act of being chosen by God started to tip the scales in his favor.
It makes you wonder what the Israelites were thinking during all of this. They saw Saul fall apart because he disobeyed. Then they see David, this young, magnetic leader who's proven himself in battle and seems to have God on his side. They must have seen him as a huge sign of hope, especially after all that conflict and bad leadership.
You're exactly right. They needed a strong leader, someone to bring everyone together and start a time of peace and stability. And David, with his military victories and that sense that God was with him, seemed to be the answer to their prayers.
It shows that leadership isn't just about being strong or ambitious. People have to believe in you, too.
Totally. And this change in how people saw David became even stronger after Ishbosheth was assassinated. Two of his own captains killed him.
No way. Even some of Saul's followers must have felt like Ishbosheth wasn't the right guy for the job. When your own people turn on you, that's a bad sign. It makes you realize how fragile power can be and how quickly people switch sides when things are uncertain.
It really does. And that's when everything changed. Ishbosheth was gone, and the way was clear for David to finally be king of all Israel. It was a huge moment in their history. The chaos was over, and a new era was beginning under David, the man after God's own heart. But remember, he didn't inherit this peaceful, united kingdom. There were still scars from the fighting, and Saul's legacy was still there. How do you think David handled all of that?
It must have been daunting. Just taking the throne wasn't enough. He had to figure out how to truly bring everyone together. What did he do to make his rule strong and create a sense of unity?
This is where David's political skills really shine. He knew that to unite the nation, he had to do something big and symbolic. And he did, by making Jerusalem his new capital.
Jerusalem. That was controlled by the Jebusites, a Canaanite tribe, wasn't it?
Yes, but that was part of David's genius. He picked a city that wasn't tied to any specific Israelite tribe. It became neutral ground, a symbol of unity that went beyond old tribal loyalties. It was a fresh start, a place for all Israelites to unite under his rule.
That's so smart. It's like saying, we're leaving the past behind and starting a new future together.
Exactly. And strategically, Jerusalem was perfect. It was up on a hill, easy to defend, and right between north and south. A bridge between the divided sides. It was a powerful message, both symbolic and practical.
So David takes Jerusalem, makes it his capital, and sends a clear message that things are different now. I bet that resonated with the people, showing them he was serious about uniting the kingdom.
It did. And he didn't stop there. David brought the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. No, it was not just the political center, but the religious heart, too.
Hold on, the Ark of the Covenant, that's like the most sacred thing for the Israelites, right? The one they carried through the desert, the symbol of God being with them. Didn't something bad happen once when someone tried to touch it?
You're thinking of Uzzah. He reached out to steady the Ark when the oxen pulling it stumbled. He died instantly. It shows just how much awe and reverence they had for the Ark. It represented God's presence, and touching it was a huge offense.
So David had to be super careful bringing the Ark to Jerusalem.
He was. The whole procession was carefully planned. He made sure the Ark was moved according to all the rituals and rules. David understood the power of religious symbols. By bringing the Ark to Jerusalem, he was basically saying, this city is now the heart of Israel, both spiritually and politically.
It was a brilliant move. It solidified his authority, united everyone under their faith, and made Jerusalem the spiritual center of Israel for centuries to come. He was a king who knew what he was doing. But there's more to David's story, right? What about his military accomplishments? Did he expand the kingdom?
David's reign is considered a golden age for Israel. He led them through this period of huge military expansion and consolidation. He defeated the Philistines, took control of the Moabites and Edomites, and even spread Israel's influence as far north as Syria. He took Israel from a bunch of tribes and turned them into a regional power.
Wow, he was on a roll. No wonder he's remembered as one of their greatest kings. He wasn't just a charismatic leader and smart politician, but a brilliant military strategist, too. He secured Israel's borders and built a professional army, loyal to him and strong enough to show their power throughout the region.
And you can't forget his administrative skills. He set up a system of taxes and tributes to support his growing army and all the infrastructure a bigger kingdom needed. He appointed officials to run different parts of the government, making it more centralized and efficient.
So he was thinking long term, not just about his own reign, but building a dynasty. setting the stage for Israel's future.
And speaking of the future, this is where things get really interesting. God makes a covenant with David, promising that his descendants will always rule over Israel. This is called the Davidic covenant, and it's a huge deal in biblical history. This covenant set the stage for the belief in a Messiah, a future king from David's line who would bring peace and justice to the world.
It's amazing how that covenant still influences how we understand history and religion. The idea of a Messiah, a descendant of David who would restore Israel and bring peace, all goes back to that promise to David.
You're absolutely right. But before we get too deep into the legacy of the Davidic covenant, we need to talk about David's flaws, the darker parts of his story. It shows that he was human, too.
You're talking about Bathsheba, right? That's the one story that always stuck with me. It's a story of lust, deceit, adultery, even murder.
It's a story that makes us face the fact that even people we admire make bad choices. It reminds us that no one is perfect, not even someone described as a man after God's own heart.
So remind me what happened. David sees Bathsheba bathing, and he's instantly smitten.
Right. He finds out that she's married to Uriah the Hittite, one of his most loyal soldiers. But David doesn't care. He's driven by lust, sends for Bathsheba, and sleeps with her.
And then she gets pregnant, if I remember correctly. Things must have gotten complicated.
Hugely complicated. David's in a tough spot. He tries to cover up what he did by calling Uriah back from battle. He hopes Uriah will sleep with Bathsheba and think the baby is his. It's a desperate attempt to save his reputation and avoid the consequences.
But Uriah, being an honorable soldier, refuses to enjoy himself at home while his fellow soldiers are fighting and risking their lives. It really shows the difference between Uriah's integrity and David's deceit.
It does. It shows how far David has fallen, that he's willing to manipulate a loyal soldier to hide his own sin.
So when that plan fails, David does something truly shocking. He sends Uriah back to battle with a letter for his commander, Joab, telling him to put Uriah in the most dangerous part of the fight, basically making sure he dies. It's a cold-blooded betrayal.
It's a chilling reminder of what people will do to protect themselves, even sacrificing others. And sadly, Uriah is killed just as David planned. Then David marries Bathsheba, erasing any trace of his sin.
But you can't hide from consequences forever, right? It seems like there's always a reckoning.
You're right. God sees what David has done and sends the prophet Nathan to confront him. Nathan does it brilliantly, using a parable to show David how hypocritical he's being and how serious his actions were.
That story really makes you think. Even though David tried to hide his sin, he's forced to face it publicly, and it's humiliating.
It's a powerful moment of confrontation, and in the end, repentance. When Nathan confronts him, David doesn't try to make excuses or blame anyone else. He admits he was wrong and is truly sorry. It shows his character that even after messing up so badly, he takes responsibility.
And that's where Psalm 51 comes in, right?
Many scholars think David wrote Psalm 51 to express his repentance for what he did with Bathsheba. He pours his heart out to God, admitting his sin and begging for forgiveness. It's a beautiful, raw expression of remorse. It reminds us that even people who are close to God can make mistakes. What matters is how they deal with those mistakes.
It's a message that still applies today. We all mess up, some worse than others. But it's whether we own up to our mistakes, ask for forgiveness, and try to make things right that truly shows who we are.
Exactly. But while David's repentance shows his faith, it doesn't erase the consequences. Nathan warns him that his sin will cause problems and tragedy in his family.
So even though he's forgiven, he still has to face the consequences of his actions. It reminds us that being forgiven doesn't always mean we won't suffer for the choices we make.
Exactly. And those consequences come in a series of heartbreaking events. David's family is torn apart by conflict and violence. His son Amnon rapes his half-sister Tamar, which sets off a chain of revenge and murder within the family. It tragically shows how sin spreads outward, how what we do can hurt those around us in ways we never intended.
It reminds us that our choices, even the ones made in private, can have huge consequences. It makes you think.
And the consequences keep coming. David's son Absalom rebels, forcing David to flee Jerusalem and fight to get his throne back. Imagine being betrayed by your own son, having to fight against your own flesh and blood for your kingdom.
That's a terrible chapter in David's life. So much betrayal and loss, all because of what he did in the past.
It is. But even during all of that, David shows his faith and humility. He refuses to take revenge, even when his advisors tell him to. He puts his trust in God, believing that justice will win in the end.
It shows his character that even when facing betrayal and the potential loss of everything, he chooses mercy and forgiveness instead of anger and revenge. makes you wonder what would have happened if he'd chosen a different path, given in to anger and bitterness. Would we remember him as the same David, the man after God's own heart?
That's a good question. It's impossible to know for sure, but it's clear that David's choices, both good and bad, shaped his life and the future of Israel. And in the end, he does get his throne back, but not without scars. His later years are marked by a sense of weariness, a realization of the heavy cost of leadership, and the lasting consequences of sin.
So, even though he achieved great things, he still had to live with what he'd done. It reminds us that no one, not even the biggest heroes, can escape the results of their actions.
And that leads us to the final part of David's reign. We see the seeds of future conflict being planted, David's getting weaker, and the question of who will take over becomes a big deal. His sons start competing, each one wanting the throne.
It's like those power struggles we saw with Saul and Ishbosheth are still there, just below the surface, even in a kingdom as established as David's.
You're exactly right. It shows that ambition and the desire for power are timeless and often strong enough to break even the closest family ties.
So we're left with this big question. Who will be king next?
It seems like every time power changes hands in this story, it gets messy. Which of David's sons is the main contender?
It's not as obvious as you might think. A few of David's sons wanted the throne, but one of them really goes for it, Adonijah.
Adonijah? I don't remember hearing about him. Why did he think he should be king?
Well, he was one of David's older sons, and he got some powerful people to support him, like the general Joab and the high priest Abiathar. It seems like he saw David getting weaker and thought, this is my chance.
So he was trying to take over. Was that common back then? Were kings always worried about someone trying to grab their power?
It definitely happened a lot, especially when being king was all about who was in your family and how strong your army was. Trying to become king was risky business. But we know Solomon ends up being king. How does that happen? How does he beat Adonijah?
This is where the prophet Nathan and Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, come in. They're like the key players in this political drama.
Okay, interesting.
They tell David about what Adonijah is doing, and this is important, remind David that he promised to make Solomon king.
It's amazing how people working behind the scenes and switching sides can change history so much. It's like a real-life political thriller.
It totally is. And even though David was weak, he was still smart enough to see the danger. He acted quickly, publicly announcing Solomon as his heir and having him officially anointed as king in a big ceremony.
So he showed everyone that Solomon was the rightful heir and had the support of his father and the religious leaders.
Exactly. It was a power move. And it worked. Adonijah's supporters bailed on him once they saw that Solomon had won. They avoided a civil war, and Solomon's reign began with his father's blessing and the support of the most important people in the kingdom.
But even though the transition was smooth, it feels like the bad stuff David did, like with Bathsheba and Uriah, is still hanging over his family. It makes you wonder if those consequences ever really go away.
It shows how our actions have lasting effects. Even though David repented and God forgave him, what he did kept affecting his family and his kingdom. It reminds us that even the people God chooses aren't free from the consequences of their choices.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Saul and David, what are the main things we can learn and apply to our lives today? It's easy to see this as just an old story, but what can we learn from these guys and their struggles?
Well, for one thing, it's a story that's still relevant today about the dangers of power and how destructive sin can be. We see how Saul's pride and disobedience led to his downfall, and how David's adultery and murder tore his family apart. It's a warning for anyone in a position of authority, showing us that true leadership needs humility, integrity, and a deep concern for the well-being of others.
And it's a story about God being faithful and working through imperfect people. Both Saul and David were chosen by God, yet they both made big mistakes. David's story shows how God can use even our failures for good if we're truly sorry and ask for his forgiveness.
And lastly, I think it's a story about hope and redemption. Even with all the tragedies and setbacks they faced, the story of Saul and David points to a bigger plan. The Davidic dynasty and the promise of a future Messiah offer a glimmer of hope, a vision of a world where justice and righteousness will win.
It's a powerful message, especially when we're surrounded by so much bad news about conflict, corruption, and people messing up. It's comforting to know that God can work through even the toughest situations, bringing redemption and hope.
I agree. As we think about this epic story, it's important to remember that we all have our own stories, our own journeys with ups and downs. And in those tough times, we have the chance to choose humility over pride, forgiveness over bitterness. We can let God work in our lives, even when we're not perfect.
What a great thought. It makes you wonder, what seemingly ordinary things in our lives might God be using to get us ready for something amazing? It's something to think about as we consider the incredible story of Saul and David and the lessons they teach us about leadership, faith, and the power of redemption.
And on that note, I think we've reached the end of our deep dive.
Thanks so much for joining us on this journey through ancient Israel. We hope you've learned some valuable things and maybe even feel a bit more hopeful as we've explored the complexities of power, faith, and what it means to be human.
Until next time, keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep looking for those bits of wisdom that can help us all on our own journeys.